Accession number 9282, Reel 3.
Lady Corbett, Reel 3.
I wonder if you can hear Sir John's voice. Would you want to shut the... The dining room of Darbunga House we didn't use as a dining room. We used the... It was a very good basement room that we made into a very big dining room, of which there's some very nice photos. And there was a big patio outside. We used that, and a very nice garden. We used that too. And we furnished them all very nicely. Then there were rooms upstairs which were bedrooms, but the thing that there just wasn't was any plumbing. There was just no plumbing at all in that whole Musharrabiyah palace. And so we got the Royal Engineers to pop some showers and loos and things into odd corners. But we found amongst the possessions of the Countess O'Geb, you know, potties and wash basins and jugs. And in the days when this Musharrabiyah palace was built, everybody had washstands and wash basins, and all the water was brought up from below. And the baths were deep sort of troughs that somebody brought up hot water and poured into. And it seemed to us this was terrible, because there was just no plumbing at all. No baths, proper baths or anything. So we had them put in, you know, with our friends, the Royal Engineers. It was perfectly all right. And the bedrooms were, of course, very nicely decorated. And we put in, you know, what had been a single bedroom, we'd put four beds into. And the girls, the women of the services, really loved coming to that place. We kept a record once of how many women services of how many nationalities came in 1 month. And there were, let me see, what was it? There were 14 different nationalities of women services, and there were 64 different women services had used our club in that month. They'd either come in for a meal, or they'd been staying with us or passing through or something like that. And we had women. By this time, the YWCA War Services was really used. The women of all nationalities were using us. Not only British, American, New Zealand, Australian, South African, Indian, Poles. I didn't tell you about the Polish in Tahag camp in the desert. We had a special building made and a special Polish group in Tahag camp, which was very good indeed. And I think the only women's services in the whole of the East that we didn't contact, this was from Tripoli to Japan, were the Russians. When we finally got to Tehran, we'd hoped we might contact the Russian women, but somehow or other we never did. But women of every other nationality that wore a uniform, whether they were ATS or whether they were SAFA or anything, they all came and stayed with us, particularly when we got through to Middle East. And I think that's all I need to tell you about Darbunga House, but it really was a very marvellous place. And one of the chief things about Darbunga House was that senior women, such as the matron-in-chief of the British nurses in Egypt, had a nephew, I think, or a great-nephew, who was a BOR, British Other Rank. And ours was the only place where she could have him come for a meal. She couldn't take him anywhere else, because she couldn't take him into an officers' club. There were plenty of other officers' clubs. And he couldn't take her into one of his BOR clubs, not even to the YMCA. So she used to have this nice boy come in and have him sit and have a meal with her in our dining room. And that was what the YWCA set out to do. We were for all ranks of all women in uniform, serving anywhere in the Middle and Far East and of any rank. So that...
This now is a residential centre.
Yes.
Did women come to convalesce or simply for...
Yes, we're now setting up leave centres. They would come... actually, the convalescent places, there were no... I don't remember any convalescent homes being set up especially for women. They had always had convalescent homes for the men, but I think they must have had somewhere they had convalescents. But they could come to us and stay for as long as they wanted to. We didn't have permanent residence. They had to be in transit or for some reason. And we even had people being married from Darbunga House. I've got a photo of an 80-year married, a young officer. And we also set up another married quarters in Cairo. Around the corner we got some flats and furnished them very well, and these were for married quarters, because after all they're all getting married by this time. And Darbunga House unfortunately didn't have enough accommodation for the married. So they could come in and have meals with us, but we needed the married quarters. So we had the married quarters. And another thing we did in Cairo was we got a very nice houseboat on the Nile. And it was right next door to a Scottish general hospital. And we set it up properly, and we had our usual quality food and furniture and, you know, as nice as we could get it.
Who set it up? You did you?
I think I did that one too. Part of it, anyway.
So did you have to start from scratch again and recruit staff?
You always had to start from scratch. No matter where you were, you started from scratch.
How did you cope this time? Do you remember?
Well, Miss Begg got the Mr. Farragella. She got the Countess O'Gibb to give us Darbunga House, and she got Mr. Farragella to give us his houseboat on the Nile, which was normally plying up and down the Nile, but of course during the wartime it was stationary. And he had these very nice cabins and a very nice dining room, because it was a houseboat that went up and down the Nile. So I think we must fundamentally have had quite a lot of his tables and chairs and probably beds. And I think there we only had to supply linen and cutlery and so on.
Where would you have got that from?
Oh, Cairo. There's plenty of places to get it in Cairo. A very, very, very good suppliers of anything. You could buy anything in Cairo.
Did you have a very strict budget always to work with?
We never had very much spare money, but people were terribly good who knew JB all over the world. JB is Jean Begg. Those who knew Jean Begg from all over the world were always sending her money, and she had quite a lot of things come in from India, because she had been the General Secretary of the YWCA of India, Burma and Ceylon. And if we really wanted something like another motor car, which we had to have, or we wanted a refrigerator or something like that, the money came. It wasn't budgeted like a government department at all. We just did our own thing. And we had the Honourable Isabel Catto as Jean Begg's personal secretary, and that was in a little building which was in the grounds of Darbunga House. Very nice indeed, a very nice little set-up there. And Jean Begg came and went there, and she had a bedroom upstairs, and that was her headquarters. But and then we were still doing... And then we set up a very nice leave centre in Jerusalem. And I've got some very nice letters I can show you, appreciation letters about those who went to stay in Jerusalem. And they are very good indeed. In matter of fact, we had three friends stayed last weekend in this house, and one of them had been a VAD, and she'd been in Sarafan in Palestine, and she spoke extremely warmly about our club in Jerusalem. So it was very nice after all these years to have somebody saying that. And the Jerusalem Club was a very nice one indeed.
Yes. Could we go back to Darbunga House? How long were you actually there?
Oh, I was in and out. While we were setting up Darbunga House, I went and set up a new club down in Suez, in the desert of Suez, because there were so many women waiting for transportation to and from Egypt. And also, there was a couple of hospitals there, so I nipped down there and designed and had built and handed that over to somebody else. We were like a couple of yo-yos going in and out of the place, in and out of Cairo all the time.
Could you tell me about that, how you actually organised all that then?
Oh, that was easy. We always arranged our transport through... the army always transported us, whether by train or air. And we had our own cars. They were our own... The cars... Our motor transport belonged to the YWCA, and we tried to get a car attached to every club, because, after all, you need a car to do your shopping and get this and get that and go here, go there. And we had a car attached to Darbunga House. And
well, you wouldn't go alone, surely, would you? How many other women would be sent along with you?
Oh, always at least one or two.
What, you had to get accommodation in the area while you were organising things, did you?
Jean Begg would say, go to Suez and organise a club. Find somewhere to build it. And when you've finished that, come back and give you another job. And so that was... I had somebody, two or three, with me. And I think we had accommodation in one of the hospitals while that was being built. It was like going to Tahag again. It was out in the middle of the desert.
So you started completely from scratch again and
had
the place built?
Oh, yes, on that particular one, yes.
And how did you acquire furnishings and staff this time?
Oh, the same way as we'd done it in Tahag. You acquired. Actually, it was very interesting when the Suez Club was first built. It was at the time when the war was developing with the Japanese, and there were some Australian units there waiting to embark to go to Southeast Asian Command and Malaya in particular. And they embarked and they set out, and they got to Singapore in time to go straight into the bag. They were taken prisoners of war by the Japanese, and they went straight into the bag there, and they were sent to the Bangkok Railway, which was a terrible place. And it so happened that later on I'll tell you how I got there, but I was on the second ship going up the Rangoon River with some staff, and we set up a club in Rangoon, and lo and behold, who came into our club in Rangoon but some of these same men, those that were left of them, most of them had died, that we had seen embark in Suez. Well, it was very interesting, that. And they'd had a terrible time on the Bangkok Railway. But this is the sort of thing which the YWCA did. You see, people came into our club, they got to know our staff. We always had very nice women on the staff, and made personal friends of them all. And then the moment they went somewhere else and they saw the YWCA blue triangle, male or female, in they'd come, because the men all knew that they only had to say, well, I last saw the YWCA in Persia or in Tripoli or somewhere, and in they'd pile, because they know there would be a welcome, and there they were.
How many staff would you have on average at each centre?
Oh, as many as were necessary. Darbunga House had to have a person in charge of the catering. That was a full-time job, and she had at least one other European plus the native staff. Then there would be somebody in charge of the desk, and there would be somebody in charge of the whole place, and then there would be somebody in charge of the... we had concerts and things in Darbunga House. And we had enough staff to do that.
And how did you organise that?
Oh, whoever was in charge of Darbunga. And I don't remember whether I was ever actually in charge of Darbunga at any time. I was going somewhere else. But I certainly was one of the ones that started it off.
What about the houseboat on the Nile? Was that not a residential centre, just a drop-in centre, was it?
No, we had bedrooms, and it was a leave centre. Any woman could come of any rank or nationality could come to the houseboat on the Nile as a leave centre. It was a very good place to go and see Cairo from. And also the nurses from the Scottish hospital, which was just down the road, they popped in for cups of tea. And on a day off, they'd come to us and occupy one of the cabins. It was very well used. And there's a photo in the book on Jean Berg there. It's got a photo of some of us, plus some YM people, plus Major Cameron that I was telling you about in Te Hag, on the entrance to the houseboat. And, well,
what would the women have to pay for a week's stay, for example, at one of the centres?
Oh, what they... I mean, they were very modest charges. What they were, I've forgotten. But a very, in, it was not beyond the means of any woman to come. We did have to charge something, and we charged a minimum amount for the very good meals. And we made sure that it paid the expenses. But that's about all. We weren't out to make profit, and we didn't. But most of the clubs, as far as I remember, they paid for themselves all right. I think that was all right. There was no problem about that.
And how much did men depend upon the clubs?
Well, of course, men couldn't depend upon the club unless they had a girlfriend. Because men couldn't come in. Men weren't invited in unless they knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody who had some connection with a woman in uniform or one of our staff. And we had some very good friends always popping in. They were very good. And so now I've told you what we were doing in and around Egypt. We had our headquarters and the big drop-in club in Cairo, that was in Darbunga House. We had the houseboat on the Nile, which was a leave centre or a drop-in club. We had some married quarters round the corner from Darbunga House, which marrieds used. And we had still had the drop-in club at Te Hag. We had Vera Harley at Tel El Kebir in the Ordnance. No, Vera had handed it over to somebody else by this time. We had the drop-in club at Te Hag. We had the place at Suez. And I think that was all. And then we had extended now to Jerusalem, where we had a drop-in club. At least we had a residential leave centre. And at Sarafan, we had a drop-in club there. It was similar to the one in Te Hag, except it wasn't in a desert. But we had a very good drop-in club in Palestine in Sarafan.
Had you set that up?
No, I was never there. Because Jean Berg, in the meantime, had gone over to Iraq. And we set up a place in Baghdad. And then she went down to Basra, where all the trouble is at the moment. And when she came back, I said, and when do I leave for Basra? She said, you better go next week. So I packed my bags and I flew for the first time in my life. I flew from Cairo to Basra.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I sat in the nose of a Boston bomber and thought it was wonderful. The boys let me sit in the nose of a Boston bomber, and we came down in Basra. We came down in Baghdad.
Were you the only woman travelling?
Oh, yes. Well, that was all right. I'm quite used to that. We disembarked in Shaiba, outside Basra. And here was a desert which was 10 times worse than the desert in Egypt. Let me tell you about that. That was really quite something. You see, there was this enormous area out at Shaiba, which had regiments of mostly Indian troops, and it had some British regiments, no Australians or New Zealanders here, and they had nurses, they had QAs from England, and they had Indian nurses, they had Indian VADs, and it was thousands of troops out there in Shaiba. And unfortunately, this desert there is made up of fine, impalpable dust that has been brought down the rivers. The Tigris and the Euphrates join at the so-called Garden of Eden and become the Shatt al-Arab River. And the Shatt al-Arab River runs through Basra. This is the joint Tigris and Euphrates. And all the dust that this desert is made up of is impalpably fine, just like face powder. And so when a wind blew, it would whip up this impalpably fine dust and it would hang in the air. And when the weather, when the temperature was really hot, when the temperature got up to 115, we were terribly glad to have the dust to drop the temperature down to about 100. But it was terrible conditions. And if you can imagine the nurses nursing in tents, no permanent buildings at all, under these shocking conditions, with this impalpably fine dust blowing everywhere and getting into everything, and an incredible amount of mosquitoes and things like that. They were dreadful conditions. And so we got the house that had been the legation of the... somebody's legation there, Turkish. You remember the Turks went into Iraq in the First World War. Well, this was the Turkish legation. It was a very fine house. It had walls that were 4 feet thick of stone. Even the internal walls were 4 feet thick. It was a ground floor. There was no basement. It was a ground floor and a first floor and a roof. And a great big veranda on the front of it, and looked right down on the Shatt al-Arab River. And even the internal walls were 4 feet thick of solid stone. And it's so incredibly hot in Basra that I put a thermometer inside an inside room when it was hot outside. And the temperature registered there was 110. Inside an inside room. And early in the morning, what you did at 4 o'clock in the morning, just as sun was rising, you had slotted shutters in Egypt, louvers, but in Iraq, oh no, you had solid shutters to keep the heat out. And then you had those sausages that you put against the door to keep the heat out. And you put them round every door at 4 o'clock in the morning. And you didn't open it up until the evening. And we had fans and we had electricity. But, oh, can you imagine those poor nurses and everybody out in that desert? And how valuable a stone wall was at the YWCA. The heat's so terrible in Iraq at the hot time of the year. If you put your arm on the metal frame of your window of your car, you'd almost blister it. It's so hot. The heat is incredible. How are they fighting that war now in Basra, Iraq, I don't know. But it was completely incredible. And
So how did you acquire the house, first of all?
Oh, we acquired that because Jean Begg had been in touch with Lady Ward, whose husband was in charge of the waterway from... He was in charge of the waterways from Basra right down to the Persian Gulf. That was his job. And he was Sir something or other Ward, Sir Joseph Ward, I think. And Lady Ward had been there in Basra for a long time. And as soon as the troops and the women started coming into Basra, Lady Ward realised that the women needed somewhere to come out of the desert to visit. How she got to know about Jean Begg, I don't know. Or Jean Begg got to know about her. But J.B., Jean Begg, flew over to Basra. And when she came back, I said to her, when do I go? She said, next week. So off I went to Basra. And we set up this place. And strangely enough, when was this, 1940? I got an MBE in Iraq and Persia, I think that was 43. It was 42, I think, when we went there. and we just set up this club. And
what were your first impressions of it?
What, Basra?
Yes.
Oh, he was just another desert. This one was covered in date palms. That's the incredible heat. The heat there is incredible. It's incredibly... I don't like the heat very much. But when it gets over 90, and the date-ripening wind blows, which is a moist wind, that's really hot. You just drip all day. And the men's khaki shirts all had water running down. You know, the backs were all dark coloured because of the perspiration that came out. Oh, you coped. You had to.
But it must have been very exhausting working in those conditions.
I don't think we found it. I mean, I have this incredible health. It didn't affect me much. Except that I was... I'm the sort of person that drips. And at the moment the temperature gets up, I begin to run. The perspiration runs off my arms. I'm always like that in the heat. And we had dancers. We went dancing. And if you went out for a dinner party or you went dancing, I had to wear a bath towel around my neck in order to collect the perspiration. And another thing you had to do in Basra was you always drew your bath water in the morning. Because if you drew it in the afternoon, the pipes that had been in it got so hot, you got into a boiling hot bath. I mean, that's heat. Really quite incredible. And but we had this very nice club. And also, the engineers told me that there was such a thing as an air conditioner. And we installed two air conditioners in one big room we had upstairs, in which we had about four or six beds, so that the nurses from Shaiba could come in and be cooler. The night nurses could come in and sleep there. Because it was, I think we dropped the temperature from 110 down to, 95 or something like that. But those were the conditions. And then in Basra, we always slept on the roof. We had sort of cages built up above. And we had in order to shade the beds from the morning sun, because the temperature warmed up the moment the sun came over the horizon, we had special shades put at an angle so that we had the shade on the bed. And you won't believe this, but we also took up two buckets of water for every bed, and they were noir tape, that cotton tape that was in and out like this. And in order to go to bed, you were sleeping on the noir tape. You couldn't be on a mattress, it was too hot. So you picked up your two buckets of water and you threw it at the bed to make it wet. And then you put on two fans that...